My guest today is Dom Wells, and he had a pretty interesting career path. Back in 2008, he was an English teacher in Taiwan, and 14 years later, he went public with OnFolio, which is a holding company for a number of online businesses. Agencies, softwares, affiliate websites, you name it. So how did he get there? What mistakes did he make along the way? How does he approach digital marketing? We covered all of these things during our chat, and there's a lot you can learn from it. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tim Solo, and you're listening to Ahrefs Podcast.
Ahrefs Podcast.
Hey, Dom. Thanks a lot for coming to Ahrefs Podcast. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
We've known each other for quite a while, actually, met a few times. And I know you as someone who is holding a portfolio of companies. And I'm very interested to dig into that because you basically, I think you started as a teacher somewhere in Asia before going into SEO, and then you had your own agency, and then you basically arrived from agency to a portfolio of companies.
Yeah, that's right.
Is this quick recap correct?
Yeah. I was teaching English until 2012, and then started learning how to build SEO affiliate sites, and 2014 started my own agency, and fast forward to today.
So let's talk about today. So you have a portfolio of companies, and as far as I know, you have all sorts of businesses there. So you have service-based agencies, you have some content sites, you have plugins, you have courses.
We have one e-commerce business as well. But you're about right.
So how many businesses do you have total?
Well, we've got six that drive the majority of the revenue. I think we're going to finish the year at around $5 million in revenue total across the portfolio. So these are all quite small businesses. Six of them, which would be, there's a small marketplace, there's the WordPress plugins, some agencies, one small e-commerce business, and an online course. They drive probably 90% of the revenue. We have some small content sites. Actually, we probably have about a dozen content sites, but these are small ones that maybe generate like $1,000 a month each. So we don't really care about them anymore. They're kind of like the forgotten nieces and nephews of the portfolio.
What are some of the most recent businesses that you acquired?
The most recent one was ContentElect.com, which was primarily doing content for a lot of companies, and it does still do content.
Is this an agency?
Yeah, it's an agency. So they do a mixture of SEO. So for example, they've got a pretty good Harrow link building service, and they also do content, and they've been pivoting a little bit more towards link building because people aren't paying for content as much as they were before. But that being said, they just signed a pretty large contract with a pretty large brand that everybody will have heard of to do all their content. So there are still people out there paying for high quality content. Then the next most recent acquisition was two WordPress plugins. They're kind of like security plugins. And then another agency as well, an SEO agency, SEO Butler, which many people may be familiar with. Yeah.
So you mentioned somewhere in your previous interviews that you are not too eager to acquire content sites anymore. And like you just mentioned, your most recent purchases or acquisitions rather were agency and plugins. So what's the deal with content sites? You don't see anything good on the market lately or some other reasons?
Yeah, I think I should also specify when I say content sites, for me, a content site is like a small niche affiliate marketing website, like an Amazon affiliate site or something. There's a lot of content sites out there that other people would define as content sites, which are very high quality authority blogs that are probably still good acquisitions. But OnFolio used to only focus on those small affiliate sites, so I kind of have to tell people that's not what we do anymore. I also think they're not good as acquisitions, but not necessarily bad as business models. For us, when we're doing due diligence on a business, we're kind of asking ourselves, is this business still going to be here in 6 months or in a year or in 3 years? And when something is like 99% of its traffic comes from Google, there's no real distinction it has over its competitors. So, you know, maybe it ranks for best SEO plugin or Ahrefs versus SEMrush. If that website lost all its rankings, it would be replaced by a website that basically has almost identical articles. And
yeah,
it's really hard to do due diligence on something and say with any level of confidence that's still going to be here in a week, let alone in seven years. If people were saying to me, why do you not like content sites? I would say I don't like buying them, but I still love owning them. If I had to start again today from scratch, I would probably start a content site because I like writing. So that's kind of the irony there. But yeah, I just think it's really hard to predict what's going to happen next with an acquisition that's that heavily reliant on SEO.
I wonder, like, what is going on the market of those content/affiliate websites today, and how it changed compared to 5 years ago. Because my own impression is that there are a lot of people these days who have those basic skills to launch an affiliate website. Like, it's no secret anymore how to do keyword research, how to find niches, how to find different affiliate offers or products on Amazon. It's not a secret how to get links in all sorts of white hat, gray hat, and black hat ways. So it feels that the number of websites that are being built and that are listed for sale was just growing in the past like 5 years. Is this your impression as well or no?
Yeah, and I think you also had people who were building businesses specifically with the intent to flip them. So someone would say, yeah, you know, I'm going to build a business, I'm going to get it to 3K a month, and I'm going to sell it for 120K or even 150K. And they would do that, and maybe it's kind of crazy, really, because, you know, you build a business and you get it to 3K a month in a year or in, yeah, around a year, some people did it in, and then they suddenly get life-changing money. I think people are still doing that. I think the amount of buyers is rapidly decreasing. And so I think the market is still there in terms of the inventory. And if you want to buy those businesses, there's probably less competition now. But it's nowhere near like a frothy marketplace like it was probably up until about 2021.
Well, what bothered me personally about this market, like you're saying, a lot of people build those businesses to sell, which means that their objective is to, with maximum efficiency, bring the website or the business to the top of its revenue, no matter what strategies or tactics they would use, flip it while it's at the top. And then basically they don't care if it would survive the next Google update. So
yeah,
whenever I was considering, like, should I put some of my money into acquiring a bunch of these content websites, I always thought that it would probably be a nightmare to analyze even their backlink profile and predict if they are going to get hit or not. I wonder what is your impression of that? How risky it is to purchase those sites? And how sure can you be that when you dig into, I don't know, their content structure, their content quality, their backlinks, yada, 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 how sure can you be that, okay, this looks like a website that would stand the test of time?
Well, yeah, that's why we don't buy them anymore. I mean, you're absolutely right. And it used to be, first of all, Google used to be a lot more predictable. It was kind of, as long as you don't do anything black hat, or as long as we don't catch you doing anything black hat, your website is fine. And so when you were approaching an acquisition, let's say it was on Empire Flippers, you're just basically sticking the site into Ahrefs and looking at the backlink profile and being like, are these PBNs? And even today, when you look at a listing on Empire Flippers, one of the questions is, did you use PBNs? And it's kind of it's almost an irrelevant question now. but it's still there because that's what people's biggest concern was. I would actually say to people, I don't care if you've used PBNs, but I want you to tell me if you have, because the worst is when they say they haven't and you know they actually have and they've done a good job of hiding them. But the risk really used to be, is this site going to get caught doing something dodgy? Whereas now it's really, really good sites are still getting smashed in Google updates. So that's kind of the challenge and why we just say, well, it's too hard to know. But yeah, I remember seeing when there was the thing with Income Store about 2 years ago where Income Store basically bought a bunch of websites. They didn't know how to operate them. They ended up kind of turning themselves into a Ponzi. And then the administrator or the person who kind of got appointed by the government to come in and try to get money back for investors, supposedly that person started coming after some of the people who had sold those websites. I'm not sure if anyone actually got contacted. Yeah, I never got contacted, and I sold them a site in 2015 or something. But there was a lot of talk about it, and I remember one person commented saying, maybe affiliate marketers deserve this because we build these sites. We don't care whether they're going to, we don't care what happens after we sell them. Exactly what you just said. We maximize the growth. We'll use PBNs. We'll use, what were people using? Scholarship links. We'll use every tactic we can and then pull the ripcord and get out before it's too late. And then the site tanks afterwards and we're kind of like, well, you know, you bought it as it was seen. And so, you know, maybe now the fact that there are buyers who are realizing this is the case and are not coming in and just throwing money at these businesses. And so it's hard for these people to sell their websites now. You know, it's kind of like maybe it's our own fault. That being said, it's a shame that the people out there who are building good businesses are also struggling because Google's kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and just, you know, making it hard for anybody to reliably stay ranking.
So we can probably call those throwaway content sites because, yeah, people just don't care what happens to them. I wonder, like, from your experience browsing different marketplaces like Empire Flippers, Flippa, there were a few more. How many kind of legit content sites, kind of media companies, do you see that don't only rely on affiliate links, but more so building a brand, building an audience, maybe striking partnerships with different brands, maybe have some sponsored content in a given industry? So how many of them are up for sale, or do people not typically sell those?
They're usually valued higher. It's something that Greg from Empire Flippers has been telling people to do for years as well. He's saying, turn your affiliate site into a media brand. They're there. I think usually they're not really defined as media brands or content sites. Usually they have a service that they sell, they have a course, or they have like a piece of software attached to them. So those ones, yeah, they exist, and those are great acquisitions and the kind of thing that we like to buy. There's not as many of them because I think they're not as easy to build. And so there aren't people just building them and selling them straight away. Maybe people hold on to them, or maybe they don't stay on the marketplace very long, or they sell to a strategic buyer. But yeah, I mean, they exist and they're great.
Just roughly, out of 100% of content sites, how many listings would you see with those kinds of companies? Like 10%, the top of your head.
It's small. I mean, yeah, if you told me this question in advance, I'd have done some research. But from memory, no, it's okay. I'm just saying I'd love to actually know the answer to that. I think off the top of my head, let's say 10%. Yeah.
10%. I'm just asking this because if someone after our conversation would go and consider to buy a content website, as they would be browsing the marketplaces, I just want to manage their expectations that the vast majority of content sites that they would see are kind of made to sell affiliate websites, and you'd have to be very good at digging into their SEO strategies to be able to figure out if they're going to survive the next few content updates, the next few algorithm updates, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, yeah.
So these were websites that are relying on SEO traffic to survive. What about businesses and projects that are relying on paid traffic? Do you have any of those in your portfolio?
Yeah, actually, Proofread Anywhere, which is an online course that we bought just over a year ago. I would say the majority of its traffic, it has a pretty good blog. It gets traffic to its blog. It's got like a DR of, I want to say 70 something, or maybe it's in the 50s or 60s. Anyway, it's decent. But most of its traffic comes from paid ads, like Facebook ads and so on. And most of its sales come from email. So the idea, you know, paid ads, email funnel, and then you make a purchase later. But yeah, we've got that. And then Vital Reaction, which is our smaller e-commerce business. It does about 600K a year revenue. That one also largely relies on Facebook ads and then email funnel.
So it seems when I'm asking you about driving paid traffic to your portfolio companies, it's predominantly Facebook paid traffic.
Yeah, well, we do both, but yeah, I'd say predominantly Facebook with some Google as well.
So I've been asked this question a few times. We have a bunch of marketing channels at Ahrefs where we are investing a certain amount of effort, money. And I was asked, do you see any channels where you can kind of double your spend and double your return, basically? Do you feel like that with the paid traffic businesses that you own? Can you just ramp up the spend and get more in return?
So the answer is yes, but not always. So it's heavily dependent on the business itself, what it is you're selling, how large the audience is, and kind of how large the business is as well. Like, is it early in its life cycle? So Proofread Anywhere, for example, if we double the ad spend, we probably won't double the return because you just start to get diminishing returns as you scale. Maybe we've kind of optimized for the best ROI right now. If we increase the ad spend, we'll make more money. We'll definitely make more revenue, but maybe you start to be like, let's say right now it's like, you know, you spend $4 to make, you spend $1 to make $4.
Mm-hmm.
If we double that spend, maybe it's like you spend $1 to make $1.50. And so you think, you know, do we want to do that because it's still profit, or do we, you know, are we kind of happy with where we are? But then, and same with Vital Reaction. I think if Vital Reaction increased its spend, there's potential for it to just spend unprofitably and just generate revenue. But, you know, your gross margins are taken away by the ad spend. But in newer business, so for example, we launched a business about two weeks ago. I sponsored some emails and got very high return. It helps that it's a very high margin profit product. But I could probably 10x my marketing spend on that one, and it would 10 or even 20x the... Well, theoretically, we'd run into bandwidth issues if we did that, but it could 10x the return. But then you get to the point where you say, well, what if we 10x again? Then you're probably not going to 10x again. So it really depends on, you know, where is the business in its
So
in its
are you going
cycle.
To 10x or not?
Probably, but it's a service business, so we need to make sure our processes can handle that kind of scale. But yeah, I'm talking about like I spent a few grand, and so can I spend 10 grand? Sure. You know, can I spend 100 grand? Probably not. Not yet. So, you know, it just depends on your capabilities.
Do you manage your ad strategy in-house, or you have some agency who handles that for you?
It depends on the brand. So each brand is kind of responsible for its own sales and marketing. Some of them will work with agencies, some of them will do it in-house. I think Proofread Anywhere, it works with an agency for some of its... So for Facebook, I think it works with an agency, but it also has an in-house person to work with the agency. Mm-hmm. And then for YouTube, it's cheaper and you're going to get better results in the beginning to work with an agency. And then as you scale, it becomes cheaper to do it in-house, just because of the kind of the way agencies get paid. But yeah, we basically do a mixture.
Mm. Okay. So one other interesting thing that I've learned from you back when we were chatting at Chiang Mai is that you prefer to buy businesses and kind of sustain them long term. This is your strategy, rather than try to buy a business which seems underperforming and try to kind of optimize everything about it and grow it as much as you can. I wonder, how did you arrive at this? Because it seems like the common sense is telling you you want to buy a business where you see opportunity to grow it. So someone is not managing or marketing this business well enough, and you clearly see how you could squeeze more out of it. So you buy it and you ramp it up, and then maybe you sell it afterwards. I'm sure you tried doing that. Did you?
The answer to that question, I've thought about it a lot over the years. And I think, first of all, yeah, that's how we first started out. I'd say, look at this business. It's terrible. It's got a really bad email funnel. It's got, it's got A, B, and C thing wrong with it. I'm going to buy it and fix it. And a lot of the time, we weren't able to fix it because maybe the person you're buying it from has already tried that. Now that with small wins, sure, you can do it. So back in the day, we would buy a business that didn't, like, let's say it's an Amazon affiliate website and it didn't have any comparison tables. It didn't have display ads or anything. So you could buy it and improve it a little bit. But sometimes you find a business where it doesn't have a good funnel and you think, okay, I'm just going to buy it and improve the funnel, and nothing happens. Like, it doesn't improve. And I think the danger of that strategy is you start looking for really terrible businesses so that you can then improve them. And if you can't improve them, you've just got a bunch of terrible businesses. The other side is, I think it really depends what you're good at. So we're really good at operations, and we're really good at buying agencies and making the agencies better, whether that's more efficient, whether it's producing a higher quality product or service, or just being more stable with its offerings. Like, oh, let's improve the gross margin because it's only doing 20%. We can turn it into 35%. What we're not good at is knowing for sure that we can come in and improve the marketing or the sales. And so for us, you kind of have to optimize for what you're good at rather than what theoretically makes the most sense. But I think there's probably others out there who should do what you said. It just really depends on what, you know, exactly what it is that you're good at and what you're set up for. Like, if we bought a bunch of SaaS businesses, we'd probably struggle because we're good at agencies. But somebody else should totally go out and buy a bunch of SaaS businesses. But that being said, we are working on that as well, because we've realized the levers to grow an agency are kind of always the same. You've got to work on their margins. You've got to cut the projects that they're doing that aren't actually profitable or take too long to fulfill, and then just go kind of sell like mad, and you scale that way. And so we are getting better at finding businesses where we think, actually, we can improve this one. Let's do it. But it's just taken us a long time to really understand that.
Let me go back to what you said in the beginning of your answer, that whenever you think that something is done badly or incorrectly or can be improved, and then you try to improve it and it doesn't work, and maybe the person tried that already, this is so awesome, because there's kind of this, I don't know, it's not a trend, but this angle of creating content when you basically criticize the work done by others. So let me grill someone's homepage, let me grill someone's content strategy, etc., etc. And people kind of make themselves look smart on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on their blogs, in their newsletter. But maybe the things the way they are, because like a lot of stuff has been tried before, and that stuff either didn't work or didn't make any significant difference. And so it's one thing to talk about it and like come up with all your great ideas of what can be improved, It's another thing to actually put your money where your mouth is, buy a business, try to do those things, and then realize that, oh, actually your ideas were not that great. And another thing that you said that I really loved, basically, if you're looking for terrible businesses that you think you can improve, then you're going to buy terrible businesses, essentially. This is so awesome.
Yeah, one thing I like to ask people when I'm doing due diligence on their business is, I'm just like, tell me everything you tried that didn't work. And obviously tell me what did work as well, because maybe I think something's going to work and you can save me time. And also sometimes then you can find the more obvious opportunities. Like, let's say somebody's got a big email list and they only email their list once a month or once a week. So you think, oh, great, I can just email them every day and I'll make five times the money. So you might say to them, have you ever tried emailing them more? And some founders would be like, no, I hate email, so I don't email people more than once a week. And then you're like, oh, okay, maybe I can make more money because I don't hate email, I like money. But maybe they say, yeah, I tried emailing them every day and my deliverability went down and my spam complaints went up and I didn't make any more money. So I went back to once a week because it's the sweet spot. And then you're like, okay, thanks. You know, that just validated something for me or invalidated something. So yeah, really, it's just about, you know, the other thing is we always try to grow the businesses we buy, but we want to set ourselves up so that if we fail to grow them, that's still okay. Like, we've made a good acquisition. And I think that's a much safer approach.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. And along these lines, another piece of advice that I really enjoyed from you back at Chiang Mai is when you said that as you're bringing some top executives to the business, whether CEO or CMO, and you're asking them, what are some things you're going to do in your first 3 to 6 months? And they start giving you tons of ideas. I would change that. I would change this. I would fix that. This is not what you're looking for. You're looking for someone who would dig deep into the business to understand essentially why things are how they are, not make any disruptive moves. And only then, once they have a good grip on what's happening, they would start playing around and iterating.
Yeah, I mean, that just comes from experience. Like, I think sometimes people can highlight something that's really obvious changes that they want to make. And you say, yeah, okay, great, do that. But in our experience, we used to hire people who would do a really good job of listing all the things that could be improved with a business. Like, this isn't very good. This isn't very good. Let's improve that. I would change this. Why haven't they done that? You know, all of these things. And you get super excited and you're like, oh my God, we're going to double this business. We're going to buy it on Friday and double it on Monday. And just in our experience, either those things don't work out or that person turns out they don't necessarily have the ability to execute on all of their ideas. And so often when somebody comes in and they list all the things they're going to change and this and that and everything, we're not necessarily afraid of that type of person because they have ideas of things to change, but it's because they probably lack skills in execution and they're better at ideas. I don't know what it is, but we rarely find people who have a ton of ideas and are really good at executing. So what we'd rather do is someone who knows how to hire that kind of person as like a VP of marketing or something. Then you're going to get the ideas plus you're going to get the actual execution.
Yeah, coming up with ideas, it's not that big of a skill, to be honest, especially if you can come up with 10 ideas and just one of them works. Is it like a good thing? Is it a bad thing? But yeah, to be able to consistently carry out those ideas, execute on these ideas, and have results. Yeah, I definitely think that makes a lot of sense. And especially whenever a person or a candidate starts telling you a bunch of different ideas that they have, and you ask them to break them down step by step. Okay, so where would you get resources for that? Who do you need? How would the work be distributed? What is the MVP that we can ship? Like, what can we change if things won't work as expected? and suddenly they start to stutter because they just have an idea, but they are not quite ready to deal with executing it.
Yeah. When we hired someone like that in the past, they had so many good ideas and they were a really experienced marketer. So it's not like they had bad ideas or anything. But after they've been on the job 6 months, they haven't really got a lot done. And we would say, you know, do you need help coming up with ideas for what to do? And he'd always be like, no, I know exactly what to do. I'm just really struggling to get it done. And we'd be like, why? You know, we're good at operations. We hired you because you know what to do. And maybe it would be they're not very good at delegating. So they'll just say to their team, here's what I want you to do, go figure it out. And the team are like, I don't know. You know, maybe it's that they are not very good at prioritizing. They've got too many things to do. Maybe they're distracted because they're an idea person. They're always like on Twitter looking for other ideas. And so just something about people that come up with a bunch of really good ideas are often better not to be the CEO. They're better to be like the number two. And the other thing is, again, going back to what I said as an answer to an earlier question is, what is it that we're optimizing for as a company? We're optimizing for stability and maintaining the cash flows of an acquisition. And so if we were buying those crappy businesses with a lot of upside, maybe we would want that idea person who's like a growth hacker or like a hungry kid that's going to come in and do a bunch of things. So it's just, you know, we've really found out what are we good at and what are we optimizing for and how do we hire those people.
So you mentioned that you guys are good at operations. So I would imagine that whenever you buy businesses, you don't really look to their marketing side that much, like acquisition, branding, traffic, and all those things. But you rather look at the business side of things, like how efficient things are, who is working on what, do we need those things? Are there any like typical things that you would cut? Whether on the marketing or operations side, do you have like a checklist that you go through?
Yeah, there's kind of a checklist. It's really about, it's not so much about cuts. It's more about risks. So like you say, we don't really look at the marketing. I think we do, but we're really asking ourselves, how sustainable is this marketing? If we buy this business, is this marketing going to work for us the same as it works for the current founder, or is the founder hosting a podcast, or the founder's grown a huge Twitter following? So we want to look at the marketing and say, okay, they've got solid marketing, they've got good lead generation, they've got good sales. If their operations are bad, we're like, okay, that's fine, because we know how to fix that. If their marketing is bad, we're kind of like, maybe we shouldn't buy this, because we're not necessarily we can't say with any reliability that we're going to be any better at marketing than the current setup. Especially as we tend to buy a lot of agencies, and you get a lot of agencies that are just like a single founder who is really good at generating sales. What happens when that person leaves? Well, okay, we can fix the operations, but can we continue to generate sales? So we are looking at marketing, but we're not necessarily saying like, hey, look at these TikTok ads, they're terrible, we can do a way better job. One thing we do with marketing though is the attribution. So we've bought agencies before where maybe the founder thinks a certain funnel is really good, and they say, yeah, you just got to scale this ad spend, this is the way that the business runs, and this funnel's super good. And then you kind of get into their dashboards and they don't really have any attribution. So you're thinking, how do I know that your sales are coming from this funnel and not from your Facebook group or from your email list or from your LinkedIn content? And so we kind of take an operational look at the marketing. Like, how are there ways we can make the marketing better by just improving the tracking and the strategic thinking about it? Rather than like the kind of creative side of it.
Marketing attribution is my favorite topic, actually.
I try to be a
public skeptic of marketing attribution. So it's very interesting that you say that you are actually looking into it and you are able to gauge which channels do and don't work. Can you walk me through some of the examples from the agencies or businesses you acquired where you could clearly identify via marketing attribution that something is or isn't working? I'm just interested, like, which channels did you look into and how did you understand that it does or doesn't work?
Yeah, I think it's less about our ability to see if it does or doesn't work. It's more that we're skeptical. A seller might say it works really well, but then they don't really have anything to back up that logic. So we're saying, how would you double this business if you could? And again, like, I've just spent 30 minutes telling you we don't try and grow businesses, but we still want to know how you would double it. And they might say, well, you just double the ad spend. And as I spoke about, in our experience, that's not always the case. And so we're kind of asking ourselves, how do we know this funnel is still going to work a year from now? And how do we know if it's even profitable? Because we often find some businesses, when we really dig in, they're actually just wasting money with their marketing budget. Maybe they're generating net margins, or it's just not working, but they don't have any way of knowing. So we're really less about marketing attribution, more about understanding what actually are the drivers of the revenue in the business. So marketing attribution is obviously a part of that, but it could be just actually the founder should go to speak at more conferences, or maybe the founder should build a LinkedIn following or something like that. So it's more directional than real, like, kind of like sniper accurate. But yeah, it's essentially kind of similar to you. We have a skepticism about the marketing and we just want to make sure that it feels like it's going to work after we buy it.
Yeah. So when you say you're trying to figure out if certain customer acquisition channels, we're talking about agencies right now, if they do work or don't work, it's not about seeing numbers in your Google Analytics, but more so applying common sense to figure out, like, what was done in terms of marketing and customer acquisition, for example, in the past quarter compared to a quarter before, and if those things have created any significant changes in the amount of acquired customers or in the quality of acquired customers. So how do you gauge what works and what doesn't?
A lot of guesswork. But sometimes you just have to run a business for a year before you really know, because maybe the purchase cycle is a year. So let's say you've got a business that's spending 50 grand a month on ads and it's generating 200 grand in revenue. And so you think, okay, well, what happens if we spend 75 grand a month on ads? Are we going to get another 100 grand in revenue? And roughly how long does it take? If we can do it within 30 days, like, great, we can just, you know, that's really good cash cycle. But if it's going to take us 6 months, then we really need to limit the increase, because we could be just blowing 25 grand a month extra and find out it wasn't even profitable. You know, maybe we should cut marketing. And it's hard because a CEO might come in and say, okay, I'm going to increase the marketing. Oh, my revenue didn't go up, so I'm going to cut my marketing. Oh, my revenue didn't go down. That's interesting. But 3 months later, their revenue might start going down and they don't know why. And so it's like, well, maybe you had a 3 month customer purchase cycle. So the first thing we really want to figure out is, and you can kind of do this by seeing what dates people signed up for your email list and stuff, is figuring out how long does it take to turn a lead into a sale, and how much what is the average LTV? And sometimes we speak to people with doing due diligence. We say, what's your LTV and what's your churn? And they're like, well, I haven't had a customer fire me yet this month. And you're like, okay, but how do you not know what your churn is, or you don't know what your LTV is? And a lot of agency owners don't, because most agency owners, it's their first business. And so they haven't learned those skills yet, which is a good opportunity for us. But it's also like, okay, we need to make sure we're really confident in this business and its numbers.
To know those numbers as a business owner, if you're not going to sell? I mean, you say they were operating those businesses and they didn't know those numbers, but these numbers are important for you because you want to buy this business. How important those numbers are for you now that you own those businesses and not intending to sell?
Well, yeah, they're pretty important, especially thinking about things like the cash flow cycle. Like if you, for example, Facebook have something that you can switch to being billed every 30 days instead of like every 4 days or whatever, if you use, I think, direct debit, or you use credit card instead of direct debit or something. And that means if you can turn a lead into a customer in less than 30 days, you can scale to infinity. Well, not infinity, but yeah, you can scale very well. But what if it takes you 45 days to turn a lead into a customer? Then that doesn't work as well. And so you need to know these things, because then you know what levers you have to pull. Understanding your customer LTV is important, but a lot of the time people have this kind of blended LTV where they're like, yeah, my average customer LTV is $600, but you might have this product where the LTV is $800 and another product where the LTV is $100. And actually what you should do is just stop selling the $100 product, because it takes all your team's bandwidth. When I was running Humorproof Designs, I had a product that was really, really high margin and a product that was really, really low margin. And the low margin one took up all the team's bandwidth to the point where we probably couldn't sell more of the high margin one. And I had to have like a fractional CFO look at my books and point that out to me before I realized, because I didn't know what I was doing. And so, yeah, like knowing those numbers will help you even if you're not planning to sell.
While to a degree, I tend to agree with you. On the other hand, I don't like averages. I mean, as the joke goes, on average, me and Elon Musk are billionaires. So it's kind of the same with LTV. If you want to talk about the average LTV of your customers, it takes just two or three bad customers which would cancel in the first month to bring your LTV down. And then you say, okay, let's exclude the customers that cancel after the first month and only calculate the LTV of those that stay. But then you say, why not extend it to 3 months? Because it seems that a lot of customers fall off in the first 3 months, but then they stay for a long time. So it's the metric. Yeah. You can calculate it in many different ways. But I guess what I do agree with you, you have to know kind of your general ability to retain a customer, and like to correlate what your actions and which of your, I don't know, conversations help you to retain that customer for a long time, rather than the actual metric.
Yeah, and I think actually we were kind of saying the same thing, and maybe I was going too much into averages, but you kind of pointed out there that you also need to understand the context and the nuances, and that you need to understand that, again, like maybe sometimes you can double your ad spend and it will double your return, but depending on what time of the year it is or what product it is or what ad it you're running, that's not the case. Whereas if you look at an average, you might say, yeah, on average, if I spend every $10 I spend, I make $100. I'm going to go out and spend as many $10 as I can. But maybe it turns out, you know, if it's a Tuesday, then it doesn't work. So, you know, you need to understand all of those things. But I think the question is, do you need to know what your numbers are? Yeah, and you need to understand what makes those numbers as well.
So how many agencies do you have in your portfolio as of today?
Five.
Digital marketing agencies. Are they doing more or less the same services, or some of them are specialized in something?
They're pretty similar. Three of them are link building agencies, and one of them is content and link building.
Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you have sold Humorproof Designs. You're the first agency that you started, but now you own four agencies.
Yeah.
How? Tell me more about this. Why did you sell one agency, but then you bought like four different ones?
You know, you break up with somebody and then you end up dating someone who looks just like your ex. I think basically the reason I sold Humorproof Designs were, one, I was kind of I hated, eventually I grew to resent like the kind of dealing with customers and fulfilling a service and everything. And also I had already started on Folio, and I was ready to take on Folio more seriously and kind of go all in on Folio. And so I felt like Human Proof Designs is in my way and I'm also in its way. I've got team members there. I've got customers there. I should sell it, use that money to hire my first staff at OnFolio, and get out of its way. And then it gets out of my way. And the person who bought it from me ended up, I think he sold the business as well. And he sold it for, I think, double what he bought it from me for. So in some ways, I'm like, whoops, maybe I should have held it. But in another way, I'm like, well, that shows that was the right decision. And OnFolio is worth a lot more than both of them were worth. So it was the right decision. And then OnFolio itself kind of became an agency because I realized I was actually quite good at starting services. Just what I wasn't good at was running the operations or being in the business. And so with OnFolio, I was like, right, this time I'm going to do it slightly differently. And then we saw Outreach Mama for sale, and we were working with some other investors who wanted to buy it, and we realized, well, we know how to run agencies, we understand SEO, so maybe we should buy it. And then we bought it, and then GetMeLinks was available, and we were like, well, we kind of know how to run SEO agencies now, so let's do that. And then when we did a review of all of our acquisitions, we said, well, the agencies have the best return. We like agencies. They cash flow very nicely. We're good at innovating new services. We're good at improving services. And we're kind of people. So we're good at everything that agencies, makes agencies tick. So maybe we should buy more agencies. So It's kind of ironic that I went from one agency to a bunch of other agencies, but at the same time, it also kind of makes sense because it's clearly what I'm a good fit at. And if somebody said to me today, how should I make money online? I'd probably be like, figure out a service you can sell and then sell it. Whereas maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I'd have said, start an Amazon affiliate site.
So are you jealous of your ex now that it doubled in size, or are you not jealous? Have you considered buying it back?
I think it's been sold a couple of times since. I don't really know. I'm not. It's one of those things where I kind of closed my mind off to it once it was gone. Like, I didn't want to regret it or anything, so I have no idea really how it's doing. But I saw it listed on Empire Flippers at least once. No, I'm not jealous. I'm happy for it. I'd much rather it grew than it tanked and I felt really guilty and maybe the seller resented me, the buyer resented me. I wanted someone to come in and buy the business and not fire all the staff. The team members, some of the team members left over the years. I don't think any of my original team are still there. Maybe some of the VAs are still there. But no, it was a success story. And it shows that I can build agencies to last. Would I buy it back? I don't know. I kind of, the service that it sells, I'm not as bullish on, and there's a lot more competition now. So I don't think it would make sense, but also like just the domain name's too long. But
let's talk about services. So it's cool that you mentioned the service that it sells. I wonder what that means. But and let's talk more generally about the services that your agencies are offering, because selling links in itself is straightforward. So someone needs links, they pay for certain links, you give them those links and content. If they need certain articles for certain keywords, it's also quite straightforward. But with content, you might offer them to do kind of the content strategy, the audit of their existing content. Maybe they don't need any new one. Maybe you can merge and optimize their existing stuff. Same with backlinks. You can audit their backlink profile. You can see which pages can be redirected to other pages to boost their link authority. You can also figure out where they should be getting those backlinks and things like that, how fast they should be gaining them compared to your competitors. So I wonder what kind of services you sell rather than just links and articles.
Yeah, that last point about how quickly people are gaining links compared to their competitors is often people don't pay attention to that. They might be like, hey, I just built 10 links, why didn't my rankings go up? And it's like, well, your competitor built 12. Does Ahrefs have that feature? Yeah, I think you should have a feature in where basically somebody puts their site in the dashboard like normal, and then you get alerts if your competitor's link velocity is increased or something like that.
Velocity increased? No, we don't have an alert for that, but that's interesting.
Yeah, or like just a way for people to, you know, when you compare your site to a different site, like
I think we used to have, I'm not sure if it's still there, but we used to have something like top grossing. So we have Best Buy Links report, which shows which of your pages have the most links. And I think there's a way to activate like which pages got the most backlinks in the last 30 days. I think we should have this view. So what you can do is you can look up like how many links your competitors' pages got in the last 30 or 60 or 90 days and compare that to your own website and see which is basically link velocity, so to say.
Yeah. It's just, okay, cool. But yeah, back to your question. I think, so typically an agency starts off selling one thing or two things, and it's what we often call a productized service. So it might be like, we do Harrow backlinks, or mm-hmm. PBNs was obviously a thing back in the day. And over time, they might start to add more services on because there's a few reasons, but essentially you get to the point where the way to grow is to start offering more things to your existing customers, and your customers are like, hey, I'm going to buy this thing. I'd rather buy it from you, who I trust, than have to go shop for a new productized service. And some things you might do for free as a way to sell your services. So things like doing a backlink audit, doing a report on how many links you need to build compared to your competitors. That is something that we do with some of our link building services. I know Authority Builders used to do it, or they probably still do it. Those are really kind of selling devices. Like somebody's like, hey, because most people, well, there's kind of two types of people who buy links. There's the ones who they know exactly what they want. Either they're like really good at SEO and they just want to buy links rather than build them themselves, or they're an agency and they're using you as like a vendor. Or there's people who come in and say, hey, I want to rank number one for flowers. You know, and you're like, okay, let me take a look. And so you might say, well, okay, you need to build 20 links a month. You need to optimize your keywords. You need to create some content because you've got like a one-page website. You need to improve your technical. And then you can either say to them, hey, we'll do it for you. And then you start becoming a little bit more of a full service agency, or you're just like, here's how to do them, or you should work with these guys to do them. And over time, you might find enough of your clients need help with this thing that you're like, you know what, I'm going to sell it myself. So with Human Proof Designs, I first started out just selling done-for-you affiliate sites. We would just build affiliate sites for people. And then someone said to me, why don't you sell content as well? And I said, well, why don't you say links as well? And I said, well, you know, I heard I should niche down and I should just focus on one service. And that person was like, yeah, but if I buy your website, I'm going to need to buy content and I'm going to need to build links. So it would be really easy to sell me those things. And I'd rather buy them from you since I trust you. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. But I didn't have the capability in the beginning because I was busy building done-for-you sites for people. And so then over time, you hire people and you hire like a project manager or a COO, and that person's good at helping you put legs on your ideas. And so you might say, hey, I think we should start selling content to people. And the first thing I did was I just white labeled other content services to validate that people would buy content from me. I think I used James Schramko's Superfast Business Service initially, and then I was like, okay, people will pay me for content. I'm going to figure out how to go on Upwork and hire my own writers and do that. And then you build that, and then that service breaks because you sell more of it than you can deliver, and then you get better at that. And then you start selling links, and then you start evolving the links, and then you start adding in different packages, like, you know, buy 10,000 articles, buy 5,000 articles. or 5,000 words. And then we had people being like, hey, do you know anywhere that I can create like these animated videos to embed in my articles? And we'd be like, yeah, we could probably do them for $5 with Animoto and a Filipino VA. Like, yeah, sure, we'll do them for you for $40. And then, okay, cool. Doesn't make a lot of revenue, but you start stacking those things up. And suddenly we had like 10 different services, and it took us probably 2 years to get there. But yeah, that's typically how, in my experience, an agency like evolves its offerings and why.
So I wonder, just generally, what is the typical margin of an agency that you would buy and how far you can push it?
I think a good agency has anywhere between 50 to 35% gross margins. Net margins, obviously, different. Anything below, I mean, I'm not saying they all have that, but anything below 35%, it becomes difficult for them to then hire people to scale. Maybe the founder's doing everything and the founder's like, I need to hire somebody else to do sales or to do fulfillment or whatever. If your margins are below 35, it just doesn't work. You can't hire someone. And if you're in 50%, then probably the lever to grow your business is to sell more. You don't necessarily need to try and get it to 60%. Typically businesses we see are in that range. And then a lot of the issues are that you might find a business with good gross margins, but it's got bad net margins because maybe they're not accounting for how much time it takes them to sell the service or do like account management, speak to clients. Also, maybe one of their services is like 40% net margin, but another service is 20%. And so they're like, hey, I'm on, you know, 35, I'm in good shape. And it's like, yeah, but just stop selling that other one. Maybe that other one takes 10 hours to fulfill, and it takes you two like actual physical weeks to fulfill. And this other one takes you 6 months to fulfill. Like, you have to think about all of those things as well as the margins themselves. In terms of what can you do to improve them, I mean, the easiest one is put the price up. There's always a question of like, if we put the price up, are people still going to buy the service?
It's funny you're saying this to me.
Have you guys ever thought about putting your prices up? No, nobody's ever.
Thank you. That's a great.
I think your users would
love it. Blame Dom. Please blame Dom. But no, definitely what you're saying makes sense. Absolutely.
But that's also why you guys, and again, it's a controversial topic that we probably don't want to go into too much, but the whole reason you guys, well, correct me if I'm wrong, the reason you guys kind of launched the credit system is because some of your services or your features cost you a lot more within your like server costs and everything. And when people look at your pricing page, they see, you know, this one has these features, this one has these features, this one has these features. And they look at the numbers of credits and think the different tiers are about the numbers of credits. But actually, the different tiers are about the features. And then if you only need a few features, but you need loads of credits, then you just buy extra credits. So what you've done is allowed yourselves to reduce costs in some ways by tailoring it so people only use the features they need. And maybe you didn't do a good enough job of explaining that. I don't know. But that's kind of the same thing. It's figuring out, well, actually, this feature we're offering people is not actually profitable for us. So how can we change things to make it profitable? And it might be you remove the feature, or it might be you come up with this credit system. And it's kind of the same with an agency. You might think, well, this service isn't actually that profitable for us anymore. So do we get rid of it? Or do we keep it because it's a loss leader and it helps bring people in the door that we can upsell them the more profitable products? And so, yeah, those are things you look at. Sometimes we don't necessarily try and improve the margins. Sometimes we actually hurt our margins in order to improve the quality, because then you'll get better. You'll get people. They won't just buy links off you once and then never come back. And then they tell everyone at Chiang Mai, don't buy links from them. They're rubbish. You might reduce your margins, but still keep them within an acceptable range, but then everyone loves your product and they go out and evangelize it and they tell you, you know, how good it is and everything. But then also, yeah, a lot of people are slightly inefficient with some of their marketing, with some of their other team. I think improving productivity is huge. And one area we frankly are still exploring and it's still early is, rather than using AI to just do the work for you for free, you can use AI to improve the productivity of your team. Maybe you can, you know, let's say you have an agency that has 10 people on the team and you think, okay, we can handle 30 clients. But if we want to handle 60 clients, we need to hire another 10 people. Or maybe you need to even hire 12 people because you need to hire some middle management as well. But if you use AI, maybe those 10 people can now handle 50 people or 60 people, because AI is just like agencies, they waste a ton of time. Like, I need to put this data in this spreadsheet. I need to send this report to this team member. I need to do this thing. I need to do that. So you still use humans to do the actual thing that people are paying you for. But you can massively increase your productivity. And so doing things like that is going to improve your margin, and overall it's going to improve your team's happiness and your CEO's sleep and your overall profit as well.
I have to address the comment on our pricing. While you make a good point, I just want to add that in our case, there was no just single one reason why we decided that it's time for us to raise prices and introduce the usage-based pricing. There's a lot of things that are going into it. There are definitely some business consideration. There are some engineering considerations. There are some considerations because of the competitive landscape. There are some considerations between like how far we can kind of expand our revenue with existing customers. There's a lot that goes into it. So there's no way to kind of put a finger like, this is why we had to do this. I'm sure in your case as well, there's no single way how you would optimize margins or increase prices. There are like lots of bells and whistles that go into the decision-making process. And I wonder how much kind of differentiation there is between digital marketing agencies in terms of their prices. So everyone is selling more or less the same services. I don't know, content, backlinks, site audits, content strategy and keyword research, link audits, you name it. So I wonder how far do the prices vary? Like, what's the bottom line prices and what are the premium of the premium, and how people manage to justify the high tier premium prices?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's signaling. Some of the high prices is, you know, everything is garbage. And when you see something which is like $900 and everybody else is charging $200, you think that's probably going to be better. So it's a little bit of a prestige thing. And sometimes it's the difference between whether sometimes people have to charge more because maybe they've got American W-2 employees and they work with clients who only want to work with Americans because maybe they think, you know, they don't want to work with an agency that has Indian or Filipino or Serbian team because they wrongly assume the quality's not as good. Sometimes the size of the agency matters. So again, there are some clients that don't want to work with small agencies. You know, they might say, how many people have you got? And you say 10, and they think, oh, you guys can't handle the work we want to give you. So if you say 1,000, then they think, okay, cool. And then you tell them the price and they're like, yeah, that's what I was expecting. If you told them the price was cheap, they just don't believe you. I was speaking to one agency owner who's pretty well known, and he has to delay how quickly he fulfills services for people because they assume that if he does it that quickly, then he must be just selling like PBN links or something. And so there's a lot of it is signaling and perception. I think apart from price, the differentiator is how well you communicate with clients and how well you fulfill. Sometimes agencies get really good at selling something, but then you buy from them and the experience is horrible and you never buy from them again. Whereas others, I'll tell you a story that is is interesting. So when I was running Human Proof Designs, I bought another business which was selling similar, almost the exact same service. And people didn't know I'd bought the second one. And a customer came to the second one who was kind of a disgruntled Human Proof Designs customer who was just annoyed that we took too long to fulfill a service. And he bought from us. And I was like, okay. I didn't know he was disgruntled with the other one. And the exact same team built the product. And the product was different because otherwise he'd know it was the same thing. But it was only cosmetically different. It was still a done-for-you website. And he was like, wow, you guys are so much better than HPD. I was using them. And, you know, you're my new favorite service. And no offense to the HPD guys. I like Dom. I think they're just too busy. They're not doing a good job. This is great. The turnaround was really quick. This is exactly what I'm looking for. Can I order 5 more? And I felt terrible because I was like, oh God, I can't tell him, but also I can't do this. Like, if this is what everyone's going to do, you know, it's too shady. And I also realized if I had 2 businesses selling the same product and one of them ran into bottleneck issues, the other one would also have the same bottleneck. So I pivoted the other one to sell a different service and I felt a lot better about myself. But isn't that a really interesting, really interesting lesson? I was like, huh, it's the exact same product, different wrapper, and your perception of it is totally different. And so then that made me realize with agencies, it's really about relationships and communication and timeliness. And essentially, I'd done a poor job with the guy the first time, and that was the opportunity gone because he was just going to go somewhere else and he had a better experience there, so he was happy.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that agency is the kind of business that you can essentially scale pretty far. And I have this example in my notes that I'm just wanting to discuss. Gary Vaynerchuk, he famously has an agency, Viner Media. And I believe they mostly focus on social media. Actually, they do like social media for brands or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a ton of money with his agency.
Yeah, I don't know how much he's making, but I think they're on Madison Avenue, so they can't be hurting.
Yeah, I'm sure that you know the industry well, and you know the kind of the big ballers, the big guys in the marketing agency world. What do you think is required to get to that level with your agency? How does one do it?
It's a good question because I've never scaled beyond like a few million in revenue, so I'm kind of guessing beyond that. But my suspicion is you have to start building out more salespeople, you know, more winning more enterprise clients, probably a lot more in-person networking. And from there, it's really just, marketing and client management and fulfillment and probably putting prices up and serving a bigger need. But, you know, as I haven't scaled a company to 10 million or 20 million in revenue, I feel like I'd just be guessing at this point.
But your guess would still be better than mine because I don't even have a marketing agency. So I guess you know more about it than me. And yeah, Gary Vee is an example of someone who is extremely public, extremely popular. So I would imagine his personal brand is helping him tremendously to land big clients because, like, he's not just any guy. He's a person who is speaking at the top conferences. He's all over YouTube. He gets invited to radio shows, podcasts, yada, yada, yada. But at the same time, I keep discovering names of very large agencies, which I haven't heard about anywhere. I don't know who their founders are. I don't know who their top executives are. And yet they're making hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So I would imagine the founder brand, the founder personal brand, is not essential to scale the agency to that kind of level?
No, I think there's a lot of in-person events that people go to. You kind of send sales teams to all of those big conferences. I think it's very much a relationship business. And, you know, I also see a lot of people, and kind of how I know this is a lot of agencies we've been doing due diligence on recently. I say, where do you get your clients from? And three or four agencies all mentioned what often happened. This isn't like the only place they get clients from, but what often happens is a CMO will move company. And when they move company, they'll say to that new company, hey, I want to go hire that team I used to work with, that agency I used to work with. But then the company that CMO left will maybe keep using them, unless their new CMO comes in and wants to use their old agency. So I was like, oh, we should start a recruitment agency and keep spinning CMOs around to different positions and scale our agencies that way. But that shows to me that when, you know, it's very much a relationship business, because, well, also results as well, obviously, but results are what kind of keeps the relationship going. But yeah, when people move jobs, they say, well, I want to work with the agency I've worked with before, then it shows that those agencies have put a lot of time and effort into cultivating that relationship. So yeah, I think there's a large part of it is just being good at sales and having good account managers and knowing how to win enterprise clients. I think what a lot of people are doing right now is spamming the internet with cold email software, and I don't think that's how you scale the agency.
So for the agencies that you own, what are the main customer acquisition channels?
Ads, referrals.
Ads.
Yeah, Facebook ads again. It depends. So some businesses it's ads, some businesses it's referrals, some businesses it's there's a little bit of outbound, but it's mostly ads, content marketing. And what we're trying to get all of our agencies to do more of now is like building a social media presence, doing better on LinkedIn, doing better on Twitter. And for some of them, it's going to events and speaking. For others, it's YouTube. For others, it's outbound. But I think one area we need to improve in all of them is lead generation. They're all good at sales. They're all good at fulfillment, but they need to get better at lead generation.
What kind of ads do you run? Is this like just straight to the service? Like authority links for $100 packs or something like that? Or
yeah, it's a little bit of everything. Like it could be a Facebook ad could be, hey, get my link report, get this lead magnet, get a free audit of your backlink profile. If it's a Google ad, yeah, it might be more intent driven, like someone Googles niche edits or something, and you know, you're trying to advertise for niche edits. But yeah, those are the main types of ads. I think there's more that could be done. You could do more content marketing, like maybe you've written a long form article about this is what I used to like doing at Humor Proof Designs, and I think you've done well at Ahrefs over the years, but it's like, here's how to do outreach correctly. And then you just do this really good article about how to do outreach correctly. And then at the bottom of the article, you're like, or you can just pay us and we'll do it for you. And then you just put some ad spend behind that.
I had a very bad experience with one agency just like that. I was researching some PPC, how to effectively run ads on Google, some 5 years ago or something. And I stumbled upon their blog. Beautiful blog, very well designed, very clean, very well laid out information. And they were talking about all those different concepts of, I don't know, negative keywords and yada, yada, yada. I don't even remember. And I thought, these guys seem to know their stuff. And they basically reached out and said, no need to put me through your, I don't know, sales pitches. I'm just ready to hire you right away. Tell me where to pay. Let's work. And they were like, oh, this is cool. We don't need to kind of spend time nurturing this client. We can convert him right away. And then they did such a terrible job right off the bat. So even with setting up their campaigns, they sent me a lot of forms I had to fill in about our products, about our company, which pages I want to advertise, why, blah, 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 blah. I spent a ton of time carefully filling those out, expecting that that would influence the quality of the ad campaigns that they would set up for us. And basically, some of the ad campaigns where I specifically provided them landing pages. So here we have a landing page for Rank Tracker. Here we have a landing page for Keyword Research Tool. And they were sending all the traffic to our homepage. And I was like, seriously? I hired you guys and I basically laid out for you kind of half of the strategy, everything I want from you. And you cannot even deliver on this. But they signed me up for a 3-month retainer. And I was like, just forget about it. We'll find another agency. Keep the money for another 2 months. And I believe back in the day, I even tweeted like the business strategy of an agency, do a good job attracting clients, sign a 3-month retainer, do like minimum work to deliver. The client will cancel, but you still have like 3 months to find a new one. So,
yeah, I mean, most agencies gain traction because the founder or someone in the team is a good salesperson or a good marketer. And kind of going back to, you know, earlier on in our conversation, that's what, to some extent, we like finding a business like that, because we're like, oh, you've got great lead generation and a crappy product. Cool. We know how to fix the product. But to some extent, we also hate it because we're like, is the lead generation just because the founder's really good at like tweet threads? So in that case, we would love to buy an agency like that, because they're finding, they've done such a good job of content marketing. We know we can come in and be like, all right, let's improve the product. Let's get rid of the team members who are asleep at the wheel. Let's, or train them up. We always try and improve them. We don't want to come in and fire people, but some people don't want to
be. I would tell you the name of the agency privately, but this was 5 years ago, so maybe they improved since then. There's no longer there's no longer opportunity to buy it. We're actually recording this podcast almost near the end of the year, so everyone is probably wrapping up 2023 and looking forward for 2024. What is going to be your focus and the milestones you would be looking to achieve for the next year? Do you want to buy more agencies? Do you want to scale some existing agencies? Do you want to buy a few more, I don't know, courses which are based on paid traffic? Maybe acquire a SaaS tool? What's in it? What's in 2024 for you?
Yeah, I think we're going to try and buy a content site that recommends our competitors and then change all the links to recommend us instead. I think that's a winning strategy.
That's a good one. Okay.
Yeah. And then no one will say anything about it on Twitter. I mean, all of the above. Yeah, we want to, I think we can probably double our revenue or maybe even triple. So we're on about 5 million revenue 2023. I think we can hit 15 2024. Mm. Maybe somewhere between 10 and 15. And we'll do that through growing the agencies we have and the businesses we have. We'll do it through more acquisitions. We've got a lot of agencies in our pipeline. We actually are sort of raising a little bit of money from our network right now to go out and acquire some agencies. And we'll buy some non-agencies as well, like, yeah, some courses, maybe some more WordPress plugins, that kind of thing. So, yeah, looking forward to a good year after what's been a little bit of an educational, tough 2023.
One quick follow-up question. Would you need to scale your team significantly to achieve that? Or do you just need a few extra key people and you'll be good?
Just acquire the businesses that are in our pipeline should bring in that revenue. So it's not going to be entirely organic growth. It'll be like acquisition revenue as well.
Okay. Thanks a lot. That was a very interesting conversation. I personally learned a lot. Hope our listeners did too. And yeah, looking forward to hanging out more with you in real life at some other conferences.
Yeah, definitely. I really appreciate you bringing me on, and it's been a great chat.